This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And we hope that this case will inspire many others.
Ree Brody, I want to thank you very much for being with us, counsel and spokesperson for Human Rights Watch. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz-Aramonte, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Honey Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julia Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, Christian Goff, Esther Godarz, I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Up next is KBOO Evening News, right after these messages.
July 1st, 2013. Station Navigator Report. Thank you, listeners. We had an overwhelming response to the recent program survey. 1,130 people submitted responses to the question, "Do you want to hear Tom Hartman on KBOO?" 764 people responded yes, that's 67%. 366 people responded no, that's 32%. There were 1,127 responses to the question, "Are you a KBOO member?" 640 people responded yes, 57%, 487 people responded no, 43%. There were responses to the survey left via phone messages, called in by listeners, emails, and given verbally at the station. These responses, split pretty evenly for and against the Hartman Show, were not included in the online results. However, next time we will have a secure way for listeners and members to respond who do not have access to a computer. This was just an information-gathering survey, the results of which are now being turned over to the Programming Committee for discussion. The next meeting of the Program Committee will be Tuesday, July 9th at 6 p.m. at KBOO. Thanks again for your thoughtful comments, suggestions, and remarks associated with the survey and what you think should be aired on KBOO. This has been Lynn Fitch.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Swan Island truck workers go on strike.
A California man facing years in prison for writing anti-bank slogans in chalk on a public sidewalk is cleared of all charges.
Oregon becomes the 16th state to call for a constitutional amendment that limits corporate spending in public elections. Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 2nd. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 2nd, 2013. Workers at the Daimler truck manufacturing plant on Swan Island in Portland have gone on strike after failing to reach a contract agreement with management. The workers began their strike yesterday and expected to continue at least until the end of the week. They are protesting the refusal of management to give them any cost of living increases in salary after a four-year freeze on wages ending earlier this year. The workers, who include assembly line workers, painters, and machinists, say they have been patient over the last 4 years because the company was in trouble. But now that Daimler is back to making hundreds of millions of dollars in profit, they should be able to get a small raise. The German auto and truck manufacturer announced in April that they are below their targeted goal for this quarter, saying that they only made a net profit of $700 million. For more on the workers' strike here in Portland, KBOO's Jenka Sokeberg spoke with Joe Keir of the International Association of Machinists Local 1005.
I wonder if you can talk about the strike that has begun at Daimler's Swan Island truck plant yesterday.
Sure. We have 725 union members that are not working this week at the truck plant because the machinists and the painters are picketing after rejecting the contract offer. The membership voted to reject the offer because it was not enough wages after 4 years of a wage freeze, quite a bit of extra work put on every employee.
So what were the main demands of the employees in the contract negotiations?
The employees wanted wages. Suffering through 4 years of the same wage while there was inflation, but also extra work. The company's production is up by 25% per worker. That doesn't come from extra equipment or process that was an investment by the company. It just comes from sweat by putting more work on each worker. But they want to be compensated for it.
And there is a picket going on at Swan Island?
24 hours around the clock, 5 gates.
How many people are involved then in the picket?
We have 509 machinists at the truck plant and another 12 at the pre-delivery inspection center, and then there are 68 painters.
Are you asking for support from the community?
Yes. We have a place right on Swan Island at the boat ramp where people can come and offer their support. If you want to drop by and offer any snacks or water, that would be appreciated. We're looking for people to assist down the road if this contract dispute goes much longer.
Again, I've been speaking with Joe Keir with the International Association of Machinists, and also the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades have joined in this strike action this week at Daimler's Swan Island truck plant. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Other state, a last-ditch effort to raise more money for education and other state programs in exchange for deeper cuts into the public employees' retirement system, failed today in the Oregon State Senate. House Bill 2456 would have raised about $200 million in corporate income and cigarette taxes. But Senate Democrats could not mobilize the necessary number of votes to get it passed. Another bill to change income tax law to increase revenue, House Bill 2456, also failed to pass the Senate. Here's a segment of the testimony on that bill in the Oregon Senate today by Senator Brian Boquist.
I have in my hand an Oregonian news article from the June 25th. The author is sitting behind me here. And it says we're still working on a plan that would raise new revenue for both schools and reduce pension costs. It also says, and I quote, whatever package emerges won't be run through leadership or brokered in back rooms, but sent to the floor for an up or down approval. June 25th. Mr. President, I have a press release from your office 3 days later in my hand. And it says, passage of revenue will trigger Senate vote on additional PERS reform. This is our last chance. It would be easy for us in the Senate to solve this were there not a thing called the Constitution. I have in my hand, Mr. President, a legal counsel opinion dated June 28th, already emailed to all members. And it tells us the obvious that we all know that have been here more than 10 minutes. And that is that we can't originate revenue bills in the Senate. So we can't put our own solid plan together, originate it, and send it to our colleagues in the House for action. If we could, we would, and we'd be on the first step on the road to recovery. But instead, Mr. President, we're not doing an up or down vote. You've said so in your press release. We're going to vote on one bill, and if it fails, then what's going to transpire is we're not going to vote on the other bill, unless, of course, something changes on the floor. And there's a lot of people hoping things change on the floor and the color of that board changes to the right number, which probably won't happen.
That was Senator Brian Boquist giving testimony in the Oregon Senate this morning, where a bill to increase tax revenue failed to pass. Another bill putting further limits on cost of living increases for government retirees was sent back to committee after it failed in the full Senate.
Yesterday, Oregon became the 16th state to call on Congress to pass a constitutional amendment that would limit corporate influence on public elections. The legislation, known as House Joint Memorial 6, or HJM 6, passed the House on June 21st and cleared the Senate yesterday. The constitutional amendment called for in HJM 6 would overturn the 2010 Citizens United Supreme Court decision that allows unlimited political spending by corporations and unions. For more on this story, KBOO's Rebecca Ney spoke with Aquini Freechild, the senior organizer for Democracy is for People campaign at Public Citizen.
People are on fire. They're angry about money in politics and corporations' power in our democracy, and they are fighting back. And Oregon is now the 16th state to call for an amendment after the passage of House Joint Memorial 6. So it just shows an incredible movement, an incredible political will for what we need, which is a constitutional amendment to overturn the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission ruling, which allowed super PACs to be formed, unlimited spending by corporations in our elections, and unlimited spending by individuals, often anonymously. And that's not what we need for a democracy.
How did this transpire, and what was Public Citizen's involvement in HJM 6?
Well, this effort was really initiated by Oregonians for Restoring Constitutional Democracy. It's a coalition that includes Common Cause, Move to Amend, Tax Fairness Oregon, Oregon Peace Works, Main Street Alliance, and others. And Public Citizen has been supportive, but really got involved in the last couple months in the final push. We have thousands of members in Oregon who are really passionate about this issue. So we brought their voices to bear, but it was really a strong coalition effort, and Common Cause and Move to Amend did a lot of work and will be continuing to do a lot of work for democracy advocacy going forward in Oregon.
So what happens next?
We're moving to Congress. Every state that passes really should send that message directly to the halls of Congress that we want a constitutional amendment. And so far, Oregon's delegation is all on board with the exception of two representatives, Greg Walden and Suzanne Bonamici. So hoping that they get on board soon, I'm sure they'll be hearing from their constituents and the organizers of this effort. But further, there's a lot of work that needs to be done for democracy in Oregon and around the country. And while this legislature has passed a lot of really wonderful pro-democracy measures, there's just a lot to be done to make sure that everyone's voices are heard, that those who have the most money are not able to drown out the voices of the rest, that everyone is able to vote and access the polls. So there's a lot of great work to be done, even as we continue to push forward with a constitutional amendment in Washington, D.C. If folks want to get more involved, they can check us out at democracyisforpeople.org. That's Public Citizen's campaign to overturn Citizens United and get corporate money out of politics.
I've been speaking with Aquini Freechild, the senior organizer for the Democracy is for People campaign at Public Citizen. This is Rebecca Ney with KBOO News.
The public will have an extra month to submit comments about the proposed Coyote Island Terminal coal export project. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality is considering three air and water permits that would allow Amber Energy to build the terminal at the Port of Morrow in Boardman, Oregon. The terminal would move up to 8.8 million tons of coal each year from trains out of Montana and Wyoming and onto barges down the Columbia River for export ultimately to Asia. The public can submit comments regarding the proposed terminal to the Department of Environmental Quality via public hearings, the DEQ website, email, snail mail, or fax. The DEQ says thousands of comments have been submitted online, and the public hearings usually attract thousands of attendees. Proponents of the project tout its economic benefits and increased trade, while opponents are concerned about the environmental impact. You can find out more at oregon.gov/DEQ.
Prisoners at Green Hill Juvenile Prison in Chehalis, Oregon, have announced that they will go on a work and hunger strike on July 8th. Their strike is in solidarity with prisoners in Pelican Bay, California, and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The youth prisoners say their strike will include a work stoppage and a possible hunger strike as well. The Green Hill prisoners have also issued their own demands, which focus on conditions inside the prison and seeking justice for ex-prisoners on the outside. Prison activist Mark Cook spoke on KABU's Air Cascadia this morning about the planned action at Green Hill.
I hate to call them children in Green Hill because in 3 years they're going to be adults. Some of them are adults right now. They recognize what was going on in California and that prisoners could, you know, bring out their voices and empower themselves. And so they decided to do it themselves. In California, there was only five demands, and this only had to do with the California prisoners. In Green Hill, these kids had made 10 demands, and they're very clear, they're very progressive. And so we want to facilitate what they are doing. That's what we're doing as prisoner advocates. We're trying to, in a sense, there's errors to correct and promises to keep. And that's what they've stated in their demands, that what those errors are. In California, promises were made to the prisoners, and they were not kept. And this is two different things. It's not really two different things. It's prisoners speaking, progressive prisoners speaking about conditions of prisons and how to correct those errors, and that there were promises, and they need to be kept.
Green Hill Juvenile Prison is actually in Chehalis, Washington. The prisoners at Pelican Bay in California resumed their hunger strike yesterday after their demands from a hunger strike 2 years ago continued to be ignored by prison officials, despite promises that the demands would be met. A solidarity action will be held this coming Monday in Portland on July 8th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at Chapman, Southwest 3rd and Main in downtown Portland.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after our broadcast, followed by Out Loud at 6. Last month, Exodus International, the oldest and largest Christian ministry dealing with faith and homosexuality, issued an apology to the gay community for years of undue suffering and judgment at the hands of the organization and the church as a whole. On tonight's Out Loud, we say goodbye to Exodus International. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather, a bit cooler but quite warm, high of 84, still no chance of rain.
It's 5:18. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It goes back to the fundamentals, intoned a Wall Street analyst. The economy is improving. Improving for whom? By fundamentals, he means the high-flying stock market, booming corporate profits, and top executive pay. Those are signs of an economy that is top-heavy, not healthy. In fact, our economy is teetering dangerously because it's not sustained from below by a strong middle class. Economist Paul Krugman notes that far from improving, our economy remains in a low-grade depression. Of course, that thermometer zooms to a high grade if you're among the millions of Americans who are jobless, working for low wages, or able to get only part-time temporary employment. Yes, the unemployment rate has ticked down, but not because of any jump in job creation. Rather, the dismal lack of hiring has become so discouraging that many people simply give up the hunt, which magically removes them from the ranks of the unemployed. Most Congress critters clearly don't care about America's middle-class jobs depression. The White House cares, but doesn't treat it as the crisis it is, so nothing happens. The only jobs push we've had is the stopgap effort by the Federal Reserve to pump enough money into the economy to keep unemployment from worsening. But rather than push harder, Ben Bernanke, head of the central bank, recently sounded retreat. He, too, uses the faulty unemployment statistic as a crutch to claim improvement. The jobless rate, he says, could drop to 7% next year, so the Fed stimulus will no longer be needed. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's shameful. Even if that was the true rate, 7% equals 11 million unemployed Americans and many millions more who would still be underemployed. From Bernanke to Congress, all government officials who shrug their shoulders and give up on helping that many Americans should themselves be made jobless.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Obama administration announced today that it would delay for another year implementation of a key portion of the Affordable Care Act that requires employers to provide their employees with health care coverage or face large fines. The controversial 2010 law, commonly known as Obamacare, requires employers with more than 50 full-time workers to provide coverage or pay a penalty. The Treasury Department cited the complexities of the plan as reason for the delay, concerned that the policies would not be effective enough if implemented in 2014 as planned. The employer coverage requirement is now scheduled to take effect in 2015. Other parts of the law remain on schedule.
A California jury acquitted a man facing 13 years in prison for writing anti-bank slogans in chalk on a San Diego sidewalk yesterday. Jeff Olson was charged with 13 counts of vandalism tied to his chalk writing campaign against Bank of America. Olson joined KBOO's Robin Ryan by telephone this morning.
Can you tell me what made you decide to demonstrate in this fashion?
This whole thing got started in the fall of 2011. As you may remember, there was a lot of discontent. The big banks had just received their TARP funds, and then immediately went out and pursued their extravagant executive compensation schemes. And this was the time that the Occupy movement was starting. This was also the time that Bank Transfer Day was getting underway. I made a decision that taking a bus downtown and camping out in the park each night was not the right choice for me. I felt like there was direct action that I could take on my own block that would be more effective. And I'm, of course, referring to the criminal racket that operates on my block called the Bank of America.
So when did the sidewalk chalking start?
I just made it part of my routine to walk around the block every few days, maybe once a week, and write some messages that would encourage folks to be warned that they faced the possibility of being defrauded if they went inside the bank.
When and how were you notified that charges would be leveled?
In the fall of last year, I received a series of voicemail messages while I was out of town about a vandalism investigation. Then, unexpectedly, a police officer from the Gang Enforcement Task Force showed up at the door of my apartment. He asked if I would be available for an interview at police headquarters downtown. And so I agreed, and he wrote all the details, and like I said, giving me a very, very fair shake. And then the very last line of his report, almost as if it was added in later, said, "And I recommend prosecution." So they put together a case that charged me with 13 counts of misdemeanor vandalism. And each count included a year in prison and a $10,000 fine. I owe everything to Tosdall Law Firm in Solana Beach, California. Tom Tosdall is a wonderful person who agreed to take my case on a pro bono basis. So the only expense I've incurred over this whole thing, actually, is besides the incredible stress, is I had to reschedule my flight home for my father's 70th birthday. So I lost a little bit of money on my airplane ticket. But no, my attorney is an incredible person who has helped a lot of people over the last 40 years, and he made a decision almost immediately upon hearing the details of my case that he wanted to be a part of that. And he saw it all the way through. From the very beginning, he showed me plea offers that the city attorney's office made that were just outrageous. And I told him, you know, Dr. Tazdal, if you want me to take a plea offer because I've reached the limits of your generosity, I will do it. And he said, oh, no, no, unacceptable. We're taking this all the way. I mean, I'm going to stay on this case if we have to appeal it all the way to the Supreme Court. He was on board. So he is someone that I really owe a large debt of gratitude to.
Jury, a vandal. That was KABU's Robin Ryan speaking with Jeff Olson, who was cleared by a California jury of vandalism charges for writing anti-bank slogans in chalk on public sidewalks.
National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden has withdrawn his application for asylum in Russia after President Vladimir Putin went back on his initial offer to help Snowden evade U.S. authorities. Ecuador has also withdrawn its asylum offer, apparently under pressure from U.S. officials. Snowden is a former U.S. National Security Agency contractor who leaked classified documents to investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald. Snowden, who is now stuck in the transit zone of the Moscow airport, applied for asylum in several countries, but his options appear to be narrowing as many of those nations are rejecting his applications. Greenwald announced today that he will soon release another trove of NSA documents that he calls, quote, shocking. An offer by Venezuela remains one of Snowden's only asylum options.
Outrage in Europe continues to spread over the recent disclosure through documents leaked by former NSA employee Edward Snowden that the United States spied on many of its European and Asian allies. The operations included bugging of European Union offices and other key political centers. The U.S. says these operations are primarily as a means of anti-terrorism, and while many countries do conduct spying operations for that purpose, the massive extent of the U.S. spying operation reminds many Europeans of the days of the Cold War. Trade meetings with France and the EU are now at risk of suspension, and many European leaders warn a loss of confidence in the Obama administration.
Despite the closure of Greece's state-run television station last month, former employees continue to occupy the space. On June 11th, the Greek government shut down state broadcaster ERT and fired its 2,700 employees. Meanwhile, former employees continue to work at the station for free, producing unauthorized broadcasts of their regular programming. Since the station's high-profile closure, the popularity of ERT's online broadcasts have skyrocketed, attracting 4 million views a day just within Greece's boundaries. For more on this story, KABU's Emily Young spoke with a former ERT staffer occupying the Greek state TV facilities.
Suddenly, 7 minutes before 11 o'clock at night, there was this no signal sign, and it was really... really horrible. I mean, we couldn't believe that. And nobody has ever stopped public radio television like that. No, nowhere, no one. There is no precedent.
That was Christina Siganito with Greek state television ERT about its shocking and unprecedented closure by the Greek government last month. Conservative Prime Minister Artonis Soumaros issued an executive order to close the station as part of austerity measures, claiming ERT wasteful and corrupt. Christina Siganito is editor-in-chief and presenter of an ERT program on international affairs and is part of ERT staff occupying the Greek state TV facilities, now broadcasting a pirated signal. I spoke with Ms. Siganito about the dramatic shutdown and occupation.
So we are occupying the buildings of Greek radio television after June 11th. When the government decided to shut down the station. We could not accept this totally arbitrary move, so our technicians took the game in their hands and started to transmit via a French channel. And we decided to continue working and ignore this absurd move of the Greek government.
Siganito goes on to explain day-to-day business at the occupied station and how they are taking a new tack to increase public involvement, bringing in musicians and a new focus on environmental, human rights, and societal issues, since, as Ms. Siganito says, they no longer feel the need to self-censor.
We are passing a daily general assembly from all layers of society to come and talk about their problems, about water management, if this is going to be privatized soon, and this is a huge problem for the whole society. And a Canadian firm is going to open a gold mine, which is going to destroy the whole environment. I mean, this is another hot issue. Health, education. Every evening there is a big debate about social issues. So it becomes a big center of culture in the city.
The European Broadcast Union, in a great move of solidarity, allowed ERT to use their facilities and broadcast via internet. Although Siganito says the technical issues remain unresolved, timing and legal issues involving their digitalization expired 2 days ago. And now, according to Siganito, it's up for grabs.
Very conveniently, ERT was out of the game. So the management of the frequencies is passing actually to the hands of private investors, who are the six private channels led by ship owners and millionaires and big businessmen. In this time in Greece, this is coming out of order. Normally, frequencies is a public good, is a public property. The challenge is that we have to keep that and not let it be sold to private investors. They are waiting for us to get fired. And then they will enter and get the management of the building. But no one is willing to surrender. So I think we are moving to a very long and hot summer. It's not sure that we are going to be employed again, not at all. We were a bit insensitive before. We were, in a way, we were auto-censoring ourselves in order not to have problems with the political will of the government. It is only now that we are going to that we are having this more free speech.
What is the latest on how long they're going to let you stay there and do this?
I don't know. Nobody knows. We have abandoned all our plans for holidays, and we are here every day. The building is never closed. We are doing everything by ourselves.
The executive order to close ERT has 2 months before it needs to be ratified by all the coalition's members in Greek Parliament. But Greek Conservative Prime Minister Artonis Soumaros faces a growing battle, even from his own coalition partners, the Socialist PASOK and the Democratic Left Party. The Democratic Left even submitted legislation canceling the order. This is Emily Young with KBOO News.
Millions of Egyptians remain gathered in Tahrir Square in Cairo today, calling for the resignation of President Mohamed Morsi. Seven people were reported killed today in clashes between Morsi's supporters and the millions of detractors gathered in Cairo. Morsi was democratically elected last year after mass protests ousted former leader Hosni Mubarak, but protesters claimed that Morsi had become overtly authoritarian. Other complaints include the heavy influence of Muslim Brotherhood in his cabinet and his failure to restabilize the Egyptian economy. The Egyptian military is threatening to step in on behalf of the protesters, issuing an ultimatum to Morsi. They say he must meet the demands of the people by Wednesday evening or face a restoration of order by the army. Army spokesperson Ahmed Ali said that in a written statement, the army is not looking to take political power, but to help all factions reach a consensus. They hope the ultimatum will expedite that process and insist they do not wish to execute a military coup. The Obama administration also pressured Morsi to restructure his government and call for early elections in order to meet the people's demands. The administration also warned that Egyptian military executing a military coup would likely result in the cutoff of U.S. aid to Egypt. Morsi insists that since he was democratically elected, his administration is legitimate. An official statement from Morsi is expected to be issued soon. The president's main priority regarding Egypt is an end to the violence on all sides, and he is especially concerned about sexual assaults against women. A Dutch journalist was violently raped Friday while covering the protests, and several other journalists have been beaten or shot. a group of Egyptians who have formed a Women's Defense League to protect female protesters and journalists, report that there were 46 attempted sexual assaults on Sunday alone. Several foreign embassies in Egypt have closed as protests continue to grow larger and more violent.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, seven people were killed in Kabul this morning in a firefight at the gate of a logistical company that supplies NATO. Fighters detonated a suicide car bomb at the gate of the compound, which spurred an exchange of gunfire. Five guards and two civilians were killed in that firefight. A new study reveals that remotely operated drone strikes are more deadly to Afghan civilians than missile strikes conducted by piloted jets. The study was conducted by the Center for Naval Analysis, a research group with close ties to the military. Using classified data on casualties caused by drone strikes, the group found that drone strikes were 10 times as deadly to civilians compared to manned fighter jet strikes. The study contradicts a claim made by President Obama in May, who contended that conventional air power causes more civilian casualties and is less precise than drones.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine and from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, July 2nd, 2013. A Palestinian youth killed by Israeli troops and army tanks invade parts of the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A young Palestinian man was killed on Tuesday morning after being rammed by an Israeli military jeep during an invasion into Dura town near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. The youth has been identified as Mu'taz Idris Sharawna, 19. He suffered very serious injuries and died of his wounds at a local hospital. Local sources said that the young man climbed into the jeep during the invasion and that the soldiers drove their jeep faster, throwing him onto the ground before ramming into him. Clashes have been reported between dozens of local youth and invading soldiers. At least one youth has been injured. Media sources in Hebron have reported that Sharawna is a student at a security college in Jericho. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped earlier on Tuesday at dawn 13 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank. One of the kidnapped is an elected Palestinian lawmaker. Army invasions were reported in the cities of Ramallah, central West Bank, Nablus and Jenin in the north, and Hebron in the south. In the Gaza Strip, several armored Israeli military vehicles invaded on Tuesday morning an area east of Khan Yunis city in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Local sources have reported that four armored bulldozers and a number of vehicles stationed at the Kisufim across the borders near Al Qarara town advanced dozens of meters into Palestinian farmlands. Dozens of farmers had to leave their lands as the army advanced into them. No clashes or injuries have been reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, July 2nd news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Casey Decker and Robin Ryan. The producer is Rebecca Ney. Special thanks to Emily Young. Our engineer is Sequoina Wright. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issues you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. K282BH, Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR, Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Andrew Geller. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, we take a look at ideas, the political ideas that shape our government and our communities. Lisa's guest is local novelist Robert Peet, whose newest book, Sisyphus Shrugged, is a response to Ayn Rand. At 9, we pay a visit to the Oregon Food Bank on the eve of their biggest fundraiser, the Waterfront Blues Festival. Ross Freeman Levin speaks with staff and volunteers at the Portland facility. At 9:30, Robin Ryan presents a pre-Independence Day look at self-evident truths, then and now, featuring the voices of local people. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on the KABU Bike Show, Kristen Dahl of Travel Oregon, Alex Phillips of Oregon Parks and Recreation, and a few others talk about the state of cycling around Oregon, scenic byways, and why should Oregonians care about bike tourism in Oregon. Thanks very much, KABU members, for your generous support. If you are not a KABU member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm online and clicking Donate Today. Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 2nd, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as more details about the NSA surveillance program emerge, lawmakers and privacy advocates question the accuracy of recent testimony from government officials. And it's day two of a transit strike in the San Francisco Bay Area.
You are part of a struggle that's going on throughout this country, in Michigan, in Texas, in Wisconsin, and even in Puerto Rico, a struggle to protect the middle class and the American dream.
Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Hundreds of people are expected at the Texas Capitol tonight as a House committee in special session holds a hearing on controversial anti-abortion legislation. FSRN's Teddy Wilson has more.
Witnesses will each be given 3 minutes to testify at the Texas House State Affairs Committee at a hearing scheduled to last until midnight. The committee is considering anti-abortion legislation that's identical to the bill defeated last week by Democratic State Senator Wendy Davis's filibuster and reproductive rights activist protest. Democratic State Senator Letitia Vandeput spoke to a crowd of thousands yesterday outside the Capitol.
Last week, you stood with Wendy. This week, you stand with Texas women. Don't you ever sit down.
Senator Davis was also there.
How fitting that it was the people's filibuster that stopped SB 5 and put the politicians currently in power on notice.
The bill includes strict regulations that would close down 37 of the state's 42 facilities that provide abortion services. Most are in rural areas. According to Stacey Guidry, a reproductive rights activist with Stand With Texas Women, if enacted, the measure would have a harmful effect on women's health around the state. A 30-day special session of the Texas legislature began yesterday, and the first floor vote is expected next week. Teddy Wilson, FSRN, Texas.
Protests outside a police station in Ukraine continued today after authorities refused to arrest one of two police officers accused in a gang rape. Last night, residents of a town south of Kiev stormed the station, demanding the officer's detention. Last Wednesday, a 29-year-old woman was brutally attacked and sexually assaulted by three men. She identified her attackers, two police officers and a driver. One officer and the driver were arrested and then released. They were rearrested after public outcry. A prosecutor and two area police officials have been fired for their inadequate response to the charges. President Viktor Yanukovych, to whom many Ukrainians attribute an increase of corruption and impunity, has now ordered an investigation. A Palestinian youth died today during clashes with Israeli troops in the West Bank town of Dura. The Israeli military confirmed that soldiers fired on the youth, saying he had climbed onto their jeep. Ghassan Banura reports on eyewitness accounts of the incident.
19-year-old Mu'taz Sharawna was critically injured by a military vehicle and later died of his wounds at a local hospital. Eyewitnesses said that Sharawna climbed into a military jeep during an invasion targeting his town. Soldiers driving the jeep accelerated, throwing him to the ground and running over him. Clashes followed and another youth was slightly injured. Dozens more were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Sharawna, a student at a Palestinian security college in Jericho, is the 19th Palestinian to die during West Bank clashes with the Israeli military since the beginning of the year. Ghassan Bannoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
The trial of George Zimmerman, accused of killing an unarmed 17-year-old black youth, continued for the sixth day in Sanford, Florida. Today, the prosecution called the lead homicide investigator in the case. Detective Chris Serino testified that he believed George Zimmerman when he described his version.